As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello there, this is The Athletic FC podcast weekend preview, and it is match day 28. Hi there, this is Adam Leventhal back once again. Thank you to Michael Bailey for sitting in for the last week. It's good to be amongst three fine gentlemen who are alongside me. Tim Spears, what has shone for you in either the things that you have created or the things that you have read this week on The Athletic?
Oh, well, I wrote a great piece.
Did you?
About Gary Neville. Which you've read, I can tell by the instant look of recognition on your face.
Yes, I was thinking I have, yes. But tell everyone else a bit more about it.
So I, instead of just watching the Manchester Derby, I listened to it as well and analysed his performance.
Yes.
Because he came in for quite a bit of stick after the bottle job gate of a week earlier. Sorry, I was really lazy. He's a very divisive figure at the moment. In fact, there are more than 250 comments on the piece, none of which I will dare to read. I was speaking to one of our editors the other day, and we were saying how, you know, Messi, Mbappe and Neville are sort of guaranteed to...
The big three.
To get, yeah, the good front three as well.
Is the beef basically coming, or mainly coming from blue areas of the country,
I think everybody. In fact, do you know, a lot of Man United fans think that he sort of overcompensates to try not to be biased, so slags them off too much, which is interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting. John, same for you. What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? I've been thinking all about German football this week because we've just recorded a show on Xabi Alonso. Where should he go? Should he go to Liverpool? Should he go to Bayern? Should he stay at Leverkusen? So, yeah.
Nick, what have you been up to?
Well, writing a number of things that haven't yet been published.
Will they have been published by the time that we release this podcast?
Ooh, interesting. Possibly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That we can talk about, that would be good.
That I've done, or that I've enjoyed my Athletic colleagues wrote a piece about...
That's fine.
...playing out from the back, which was a collaborative effort from various people, which was really interesting. Brought in statistics and... testimony from people who have, experienced extreme examples of that. And it was very interesting. I'd recommend everyone reads it.
Let's get stuck in to this week's fixture formation. We have Bournemouth and Luton replaying that abandoned fixture after the incident with Tom Lockyer, of course. So we have 11 games this week. So it is a 5-4-1-0-1 formation from Saturday to Wednesday. Okay, the 12:30 fixture returns. It's back again. Manchester United aim to bounce back from their derby defeat, hosting Everton, who haven't won in their last 10 games. The 3 o'clock GMT fixtures, Crystal Palace Luton, Bournemouth Sheffield United and Wolves Fulham, mouth-watering trio of fixtures. Then Saturday 5:30, Arsenal against Brentford, and Arsenal could go top of the league if they win that one. On Sunday, we've got Aston Villa against Tottenham, race for the top four and five. They go head-to-head at 1 o'clock. Then we've got Brighton against Forest and West Ham, Burnley, claret everywhere at 2 o'clock. Then the unusual time of 3:45 brings...
Like a really posh gangster film.
Yeah. You know I
mean? Claret everywhere. Yes.
Leventhal does East End Boozer in Guy Ritchie film.
Exactly. Oh, dear. So we've got an unusual kickoff time of 3:45. That is the big one, Liverpool against Manchester City. And then we've got the Monday night football, Newcastle against Chelsea, and then Luton against Bournemouth on Wednesday. But it is all about the title race this week. Let's crack on and get stuck in to the action on Merseyside. So at the top of the table, going into the weekend, Liverpool are 1 point ahead of Manchester City, who travel to Anfield on Sunday afternoon. And it is the biggest match of the season so far. Shall we relive what happened back in November, gentlemen?
Alexander-Arnold has pinned one in for Liverpool. He fair-fisted into the bottom corner. And on hostile territory, Liverpool have parity.
So, yeah, it was a 1-1 draw thanks to that brilliant strike from Trent Alexander-Arnold levelling things up. Liverpool, of course, without him once again this weekend. Injury still playing a big part for them. Mo Salah is back in training. It's important that he returns for this game in particular, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's probably one of those situations where if it wasn't City, then I wouldn't have thought he'll play. But because it is, I suspect he will do. Yeah, particularly with Liverpool's other injury problems. I know a few of them are coming back now, but they're still going to be without Alexander-Arnold and Alisson, obviously. So when you are missing those kind of key players, then it's obviously very important to have someone like Salah, who's, you know, obviously sensational generally, but particularly seems to be very good against City.
Do you want a juicy stat on Salah?
Let's.
He's been involved in 17 goals in 19 appearances for Liverpool against Manchester City, which is the highest number of goal involvements against any opponent for Liverpool. But he has had his wings clipped, obviously, by this injury that he picked up at AFCON. So do you have to make a sort of calculated decision on him? Do you need him more for the run-in rather than this game, which may well be a bit more cagey? I don't know.
It's a game that suits him. We know that Man City like to control the ball. They like to try and squeeze opponents really deep, and they commit players forward, and it leaves a lot of space in behind. And we've seen that happen again and again this season, that oppositions have been targeting that space in behind the fullback on the side that Mohamed Salah plays on. So, yeah, I think they will want to have Salah in the team. They'll want to have Darwin Nunez in the team for this one as well, because I think the way that they play football, Liverpool, they have to have these players who can stretch the game. And in some of the games they've dropped points in this season have been games where they haven't had those players available. So I think this is the perfect game that they want, they'll want to have particularly Salah in, because if you win this one, it's like a 6-point swing on your title challenger as well. So yeah, it will make a big difference on the state of the table as well. So I think they'll be pretty pleased.
Now, interestingly enough, home advantage makes a big difference in this fixture. Pep Guardiola has only won once at Anfield, and that was during COVID when there were no fans. Do you feel that in the current context, home advantage is the deciding factor in this game? In terms of how Liverpool are, their emotional attachment to everything that's riding on this season and Klopp's departure and all that malarkey.
Yeah, which they're very good at. You know, I felt that was slightly part of Arsenal's downfall last year, that they got too much into the emotion of it all. Mm. Whereas Liverpool use it pretty well and always have done. You got the cup final with the way they roused the team with that LA nonsense for a couple of minutes. But no, it was loud and it was special, and I'm sure it galvanised the team. These things do, you know, they're not just cliches, they do work.
I think there's an interesting point to be made about play style, because I think Liverpool's play style is benefited by having a loud crowd, whereas I think maybe with teams like Manchester City or Arsenal, I think actually too much emotion is almost going against the intention of what the coach wants. So someone like Mikel Arteta or Pep want control of the and that requires patience, and it requires, you know, not jumping in and leaving space elsewhere when you're out of possession, etc. Whereas for Liverpool, it's the complete opposite. Like, the crowd can actually have a big impact on the way that the team are playing. So I find it really interesting that, like, Anfield, the Man City have tended to I think, draw or lose, right?
Well, that's really interesting. So what you think, you know, I'm picturing obviously Mo Salah, when he gets the ball on the right-hand side, that the noise almost sort of changes that moment in a positive yeah. way, and they're more of a roaring on sort of team?
Yeah, they're a very direct team who try and get the ball forward quickly. If they lose it, they then try and win it back. And I think an injection of emotion into that kind of scenario can help you. Whereas I think because the more sort of Spanish positional approaches require you to be patient, and it's like, okay, maybe it looks like there's a pass on there, but we don't play that pass. Or the other thing is we hold our positions here because we know that everyone's doing the right job. If you jump in ahead of schedule, suddenly you're leaving a space behind you which can be exploited as well. So I do think it's quite no one really talks about this, but I think that there are elements to which, you know, the Guardiola way is, it's all built around this idea of, like, patience and control and actually not getting too heightened in your emotions. So that works at odds, I think, to the way that a crowd might want to be.
Yeah, you need the crowd to be supportive and invested in what you're trying to do. Like, I watched a bit of Burnley-Bournemouth last week, like, a bit. And, like, you know, they were trying to play it from the back and James Trafford was, like, struggling and they just started booing. And, like, that won't help. And I'm not knocking the Burnley fans for that, because look at them. But, you know, you know what I mean? If you're going to be, as John says, a team that plays patient out from the back, you need moments of silence between the passes, not like boos and like frantic, like get it forward now kind of thing, which varies from club to club for sure.
If Man City win, have they won the title?
No, I mean, well, I think Manchester City will win the title, but I don't think this is kind of, this will be game over, because it will... They'll only be 2 points ahead of Liverpool. They will, presuming Arsenal beat Brentford on Saturday, they will be still only be a point ahead of Arsenal. So I don't think it's kind of all done and dusted, whoever wins. I mean, obviously if Liverpool win, then they'll be pretty confident of going all the way with the advantage they will have. But yeah, I don't think it's the kind of be all and all at all.
Phil Foden. Has Phil Foden won any poster space on your wall, John? Do you love him?
I think he's a great player. I think he's potentially underrated. I don't know if that's... Can you say... I'm always nervous about saying someone's underrated. I think there's a lot of people who will say, compared to someone like Bukayo Saka, he doesn't have the... What is it the kids say? Minerals. To be able to pull it out in big game occasions. Obviously, in the last game, he did that.
Minerals.
So I think people are, look, not my word. Don't shoot the messenger. Yeah, I think I think after this season, he's getting to a point now where people have to say, look, yeah, fair enough, he's getting there. But yeah, incredible player.
Who would like to do a quiz about Manchester City and Liverpool?
Yes, please.
Yes.
Yes, go on. Let's do it. Let's get it over and
done
with.
Okay, well, it is a really, really interesting quiz, this one. Now, what you have to do is tell me the 13 players that have played for both Liverpool and Manchester City. And I'm going to give you, well, I'll give you 30 seconds. It will probably take far longer, but let's aim for 30 seconds, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay, and what I'm going to do is you... can guess one, Tim, then John, then Nick. We'll go anti-clockwise for some reason. And if you pass, you're out.
Ooh.
Okay? And just to clarify, this is only the Premier League era, okay? So, we will start the clock. And away we go. Tim.
Raheem Sterling.
Correct.
James Milner.
Correct.
Robbie Fowler.
Yes.
Steve McManaman.
Steve McManaman, correct. Yes. John, the pressure's on. We're up to 24 seconds. This is going to take so
Pass.
Many more 30
I'm
seconds.
Out. I'm done.
John is out.
Carlo Torre.
Carlo Torre, correct. 5 we've got. 8 more to get. Liverpool and Manchester City.
Stephen Warnock.
Stephen Warnock is incorrect.
That's it.
You're out. So do you want to keep going by yourself?
Well, I've got one more.
Okay, go on then.
Nicholas Anelka.
Nicholas Anelka, yes. Anyone else? God, why is it always me that has to come up with the answers?
Well, you've got, but you, because you've got the answers.
It was a clue. Why always me?
Balotelli.
Balotelli, well done. That's very good. Shall I just give you clues from now on? Okay. A bit sort of aggy for both sides. Quick. Probably get into a bit of a ruckus. Annoy the...
Craig Bellamy.
Craig Bellamy, correct. A German?
Didi Hamann.
Very good. Does funny videos now where he goes...
Oh, Daniel Sturridge.
Yes, that's the one. A goalkeeper?
Hart? No.
Oh, Scott Carson.
Scott Carson is one of the goalkeepers, and there is another one.
David James.
David James. And the final one, I don't think anyone's going to get. Albert Riera.
Oh, right.
There you go. So there you go. Now you can regale all of that to your friends in the pub. Right, let's get the predictions for this big one. What do you reckon?
2-1 Liverpool.
2-1 Liverpool.
I think City are going to win this one. I think that Liverpool are too weakened. We didn't really talk about their injuries, did we? But a lot of players missing for them. I think City are now sort of not back to their best, but they have the players available that Pep will want, namely Rodri and John Stones. So I think that City will actually have enough to do it.
And the score will be
2-0.
Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think logic dictates an away win, but I don't know. There's just something about Liverpool at the moment. 3-2 Liverpool.
Right, before we move on, we are asking you to fill out a quick survey. Not you. People listening, obviously. A quick survey about you and your podcast habits by going to theathletic.com/survey24. Three lucky entries will win £100 or dollars worth of Amazon vouchers as well. So whether you're a long-time listener or a new one, we want your feedback. So head to theathletic.com/survey24.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Right then, next up, we are going to Birmingham because, this is a belter, isn't it? Aston Villa against Tottenham in what could be the deciding game in the race for the top four. Villa fourth, 55 points. Spurs fifth with 50 points. Spurs do have a game in hand. Is this sort of all or nothing for Ange Postecoglou in terms of finishing fourth this season? I know fifth may well reap a Champions League place. I'm well aware of that.
Yeah.
That's not guaranteed. Would the gap be too big if it moved on to
if they lose? Yeah, probably. But yeah, I think a draw would be a good result with a game in hand. And Villa will be busy in Europe for the next few weeks. You'd assume they'll get through that Ajax tie. And then Emery will have a real quandary as to how to use his squad, which isn't the biggest, in the crunch time of the season, which is coming right up. This is going to be a great game. As far as an undercard goes, this is as good as it gets, really, before the main event. And with the way that they both play, with high lines and high risk, certainly on Spurs' part, you can almost expect goals and entertainment. Yeah, the reverse fixture was 2-1 to Villa at Spurs. And it was a great game, actually. Spurs were just going through their injury crisis, but still gave them a really good game and arguably could have beaten them. So, yeah, informed strikers, good managers, two good teams that I think most of the English football supporting public will be rooting for. And they're both showing up clubs below them in the table, such as Man United and Chelsea, who I just hate to put the boot into, but have spent a lot more money and are nowhere near. And it just shows you the value of a good manager with a tactical plan who's backed up by decent recruitment. It's not that difficult, is it really?
Yeah. But also, and they've been able to do that in a very short space of time. So all the discussion on, you know, Manchester United, for example.
Well, Ten Hag's had longer than both these managers. You know, and you still don't know what you're going to get from Man United week to week, or how they're going to play, or what they're even trying to do sometimes.
Yeah.
But I hate putting the boot in. So
yeah, you really do, don't you? Tim, you mentioned about how many goals there have been in games featuring Spurs and Aston Villa. Do you want to know exactly how many goals?
No.
Okay. Let's talk about something else then. No, I will tell you. There have been, in the last five league games for these two teams, a whopping 41 goals. 22 in Villa games, 19 in Spurs games. The only clean sheet was Villa against Sheffield United. I know everyone loves Ange and the way that he plays, or his team plays, and all that. But in the last three away games, they've conceded at least two goals. Is there a way that he can slightly tinker what he does? I don't know, maybe in like a first half or the first 10 minutes, or just something slightly different so they're not having to play catch up so much.
Yeah, I think Jurgen Klopp's a really good example of a manager who came into the Premier League and had to change the way that his team were playing, despite the fact that he had used that approach in another league. And I think the same is probably true for Ange Postecoglou. The big question isn't, and people, you know, people always talk about plan Bs, and I think no coach really has a plan B. They have like a plan A with tweaks in it. And I think the success of Ange Postecoglou in the long term, and I'm talking like the difference between the Spurs becoming a team that regularly get top four versus Spurs being a team who could potentially challenge for the title, is, in my opinion, that if he can add pragmatism into his approach currently. Now, it may be the case that that's not possible, but I think there are ways that you can still try and keep the good things that you get out of your system, and then try and find ways of downplaying some of the bad aspects as well. So I think that's a really interesting aspect of the future of Spurs, because on the one hand, Spurs do need to improve the squad that they have to be able to get the most out of this, to get the most out of Ange Ball. But I suppose the question is, where's that ceiling? Is the ceiling, if you get great players in, is the ceiling, okay, we're only going to be finishing top four, we're not going to be challenging for the top? And I think the difference between raising that ceiling then is finding ways within the system to maybe add a little bit of pragmatism without necessarily impinging on the attacking upside that they get.
I think he's right. In this day and age, if you're going to win the Premier League, you've got to be a bit more tactically flexible. Like, I don't want to be, you know, do it in Scotland, mate, but you know, God, do you know what I mean? It's a lot easier doing it with Celtic in Scotland than it is with Spurs in the Premier League. They've got years of catching up to do, and he's got to be more flexible.
Just very quickly on this, is there sort of trends in the way that these two sides play that you think there is going to be a clear winner? And obviously then take into account the fact that, you know, Villa's form has been very good, they love playing at home, etc., etc. Tottenham away from home has been a bit dicey.
It's funny, isn't it? Because everyone talks about this as being a potential goal fest, but in the last fixture, it was 2-1 to Villa. Two of the goals out of the three were from set pieces. There was one nice Ollie Watkins goal where they worked it through the lines a little bit, but it wasn't a scenario where Spurs were caught out from being, you know, particularly aggressive. So I think that this game will be exciting, and it would be end to end. It may be that there's a lot of offsides, rather than necessarily making those high lines count. And that's part of the reason why these high lines are used.
Only Erling Haaland has scored more goals than Ollie Watkins this season. 16. With your England hat on, Tim.
Here we go. What kind of player do well without it being like, oh, he'd play for England, couldn't he? It's great that he's playing for Villa and playing well. We've gone straight into England.
It's introducing broader interests. People will care more about that.
I think it's sad whenever there's like a player who plays well and then immediately like, oh, maybe he'll play for England, you know.
It's really annoying when a player comes through, like mine who comes through and plays one game, and it's like, oh, he could fit in nicely in England's midfield. That's just ridiculous. Like, let him find himself. But with the Euros coming up and he's top of the, you know, top,
so mad
top of
now.
The goal involvements chart, which is where everyone wants to be. And yeah, I think it's slightly more, I don't like defending Adam, but. it's slightly more relevant.
I think we should talk about Ollie Watkins, because I think he has been great.
Oh,
he's
right.
been
yeah.
but, you know, I don't know. You stick him in the England team and it's like, okay, all of the things that are good about him now are going to disappear in the England team. And it's going to, you know, it's the same with every player who's exciting. They go into the England team and they play turgid football. But, like, Ollie Watkins is playing really exciting football. He's got a manager who's developed a system around him. It gets him into goal-scoring positions and he's finishing them at the moment. And he's a joy to watch.
It's good for Villa. It's good for England. That is fact.
I think he's made himself the bench option for England, doesn't he, right? It's not great news for Ivan Toney because they're not going to take three central strikers. And if you're going to take Watkins, you have to use him centrally. That's why he's done so well for Villa, right? He's playing a lot more centrally than he...
But you get the flexibility of being able to move him out wide as well because he has played in wide areas as well. So like
he has, but if you're going to get the best out of him, I mean, all 16 goals he scored this season have come from inside the penalty box. But yeah, he's forged his place in the squad, which I wouldn't have seen coming 6 months ago. And now everyone assumes he's on the plane. So yeah, he's having an incredible season. He's almost up there for player of the year, really.
Let's get your predictions for Villa Spurs. Nick?
Spurs will win 2-1.
Oh. John?
I'm going to go Villa will win 2-1.
And 2-2.
Thank you. Let's head to Manchester now. So Manchester United's hopes of Champions League qualification, little violins are out for everyone. They're slipping away. Everton, great word used on the last episode of the podcast, are looking unflushable from the Premier League, which I think is a wonderful way of putting it. But they are still in trouble. Dangerously close to the bottom three after getting their 4 points back. Let's deal with the Manchester United side of things. Is this a must win for Erik ten Hag? I mean, it looks at like he's going to stick around until the end of the season, whatever happens, but he wants to at least try and make a good go of getting into the top five, doesn't he? Because at the moment, it's just a bit...
In some respects, you could say it's a must win, but... In terms of what it will actually mean for him beyond the end of the season, probably not. I mean, United probably aren't going to... There's 6 points behind fifth place, Tottenham, who have a game in hand on them. So they're probably not going to get in the top five. I think Jim Radcliffe's very, very lukewarm assessment of Ten Hag, even that suggests that, you know, they're going to be trying to find a new manager at the end of the season. So... Yes, obviously, in as much as winning games is better than not winning games, that it's important in that respect, but I don't think it's going to make a huge amount of difference to them long term.
Minus two goal difference, Manchester United.
It's impressive, really, it is. In some ways.
It's quite a feat. And they're obviously missing Hoyland. How do they score goals without Hoyland? You can't rely on Marcus Rashford doing something special every week, can you?
Yeah, there's an extent to which Erik ten Hag's systems, we talk about Erik ten Hag's system and the people say, what is it? But it is built around this idea that you want a classic number nine who's going to come in and finish goals. Yes, you've got other players in wide areas, some of whom are goal scorers and others of whom aren't. But when you don't have Hoyland in the team, you're then having to shift someone out from another position who isn't going to be as dangerous as him, and it does impact the system. So, yeah, this is a real problem for them. Because the system is designed around one player who they only have one of. So, I think in the long run, they would want to have a backup striker who they could bring in these scenarios. They don't have that right now, and we're seeing the results on the field.
I'm just going to allow Tim to just stick the boot in on Manchester United just because it's your want. When Erik ten Hag was speaking after the game against Manchester City, and it was suggested to him that it sort of emphasised the gulf in inequality between the two sides, he said, no, I don't think so, absolutely not. Is he seeing something completely different, or does he have any sort of fact to base that on? Or is he being a little bit delusional and protective, obviously, of his chances of staying there beyond the end of the season?
He sees it. When he's on, in 3 years' time, when he's on Gary Neville's podcast, he'll admit it. We were awful. You know, we were so bad. We're so far away from City, it's incredible. But he's not going to say that now, is he? Mm. No one does. So you sort of take it with a pinch of salt, really. But I sort of felt sorry for them a little bit last week in that They actually played to his tactics for once and kept it tight for 75 minutes and, you know, could have got a point on another day. And, yeah, they're missing a lot of players as well. But, you know, you compare the approach of Ten Hag with some of the managers we discussed earlier, Emery and Postecoglou, even with injured players out, they would have given it more of a go. So, yeah, and a lot of the players just look like they just don't want to play for him, to be honest. And that's why they're so inconsistent one week to the next, because it's just whether they fancy it or not. So it's an absolute sham. He'll be out at the end of the season and no one will miss him.
It's interesting hearing you compare with Postecoglou, though, because Postecoglou has carried on with his system even when it didn't work, whereas I think a lot of people have argued that Erik ten Hag, as soon as it became a problem, just ditched any system he had and ended up sort of thrashing around a bit between systems. And I think there's an argument to be made that this is it's good that Postecoglou has been happy playing with, you know, Ben Davis and Emerson Royale as fullbacks when he's had to, because the system is more important than, you know, the short term. So, yeah, I think that's kind of comes back to what we were talking about before. The Manchester United have to implement a system and style and a coach who can implement that and in the short term in order to have long-term success.
Let's talk about Everton. Only 5 points above the drop. They're not looking like getting results. So no wins in their last 10 games. Do you think Sean Dyche should be concerned about this, or do you think that they'll just be able to do enough and that, you know, maybe as we were talking about earlier on, the Anfield crowd will carry them on? Goodison might get them over the line with a couple of sort of tense wins late on in the season.
Yeah, I mean, I think they probably will just about have enough, even if they do get a few more points deducted. I suspect it will be between Forest and Luton for the sort of third relegation place. But yeah, if this run continues for much longer and if they have as much trouble scoring goals, certainly from whoever's playing at centre forward, then yeah, there's some real problems. I mean, I don't know. They don't. They have looked a little bit less like a sort of dicey team recently. Maybe that kind of that is reliant on a kind of reliable number nine. But yeah, it feels like they've lost a little bit of something recently, and you know, who knows? Maybe a game against hapless Manchester United will be the way to kind of pick that up again.
You mentioned the points. I mean, it's absolutely farcical that nobody knows how many points are needed to be in the relegation zone or out of it at the moment, and the fact that there are probably going to be more changes in the next few weeks. Like this cannot happen again. Like, it's just ludicrous. And you know, if Luton are approaching the game and saying, oh, you know, do we need a point here or 3 points here to sort of chisel our way, or are we 6 points off, so we need to go gung-ho for victories? Like, it's having a massive impact, like, week by week at the moment. It's like, it's farcical.
And it might not be resolved before the end of the season as well,
yeah,
which is it's absurd thing.
Yeah.
Right, should we have a prediction then? That's fun. Manchester United against Everton. Nick?
2-2.
Two numbers from John.
2-1.
And two numbers from Tim.
1-0.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being on the show. Tim, have a lovely weekend.
Cool, you too.
John, and you.
I will.
And Nick, the same to you.
Thanks very much.
And you'll be back with your briefing column on Monday?
Yes, Monday morning.
Excellent. Look forward to it. Thank you very much for listening. IO is going to be back on Monday, and we will be back next Friday with another weekend preview. Thank you very much for listening. Take care.
The Athletic.